Hello, America and the world. This is Radio Free Market, and I'm your guest host, Drew Yelm, sitting in for Radio Free Market founder, Michael McKay. We are behind the lines of socialism, my friends, and Radio Free Market is the voice of free people and free markets. Our topic today is money, sound and unsound, from gold to paper in the 20th century. How did we get to a time where currencies can rise and fall in such short order? What happened to sound money? To better understand these issues, today we are lucky to have Dr. Joseph Salerno as our guest. Welcome to the show, Dr. Salerno.
I'm happy to be here, Drew.
Dr. Salerno is Academic Vice President of the Ludwig von Mises Institute, Professor of Economics at Pace University, and Editor of Quarterly Journal of Austrian Economics. He is the author of Money Sound and Unsound, a collection of his essays and articles dealing with issues in money and economic history from an Austrian perspective. Also in studio with me is Zach Halstead. Welcome to the show, Zach.
Thanks, Drew. Good to be here.
Zach is a finance and accounting major at the University of Iowa and president of the University of Iowa Students for Austrian Economics. So, Dr. Salerno, I'd like to begin by talking about the history of the gold standard by getting our terms correct. What exactly is a gold standard?
A gold standard is a money which uses a commodity. That commodity is gold. As the medium of exchange. That is, that's what people use on an everyday basis to make their transactions. So there are many different forms of the gold standard. I mean, a pure gold standard would be one in which the actual coins were used, or certificates of ownership to those coins, which would then be stored in vaults of banks and so on. So when money first arose, it really arose as sort of a pure commodity money, gold or silver or even copper. And then the gold standard that most people are familiar with is the gold standard called the classical gold standard, which emerged in the 19th century and did have some government involvement, though, again, it was a much sounder money than the fiat currency that we have today.
So why exactly are so many currencies in the world today named after units of weight, such as the peso, the pound, or the mark?
That's a good question. And the answer to that goes back to the fact that almost all monies historically arose as a unit of silver or gold. So they circulated by weight. Since they were commodities, it was their weight that was important. So, for example, the U.S. dollar was legally defined for over 100 years as about 1/20 of an ounce of gold, whereas the pound, the British pound, was defined as about 1/4 of an ounce of gold. So, therefore, you had what's called fixed exchange rates. They weren't really fixed. They were just different weight units of the same money. So, for 100 years, it took $4.86 to buy one British pound because it was four times the amount of gold in a pound as it was in a dollar. So think of it this way. It was like the relationship between a nickel and a quarter. Okay, a quarter is defined as a fourth of a dollar, and a nickel is defined as a 20th of a dollar. So it was the arithmetic relationship that established the exchange rate. They weren't actually different monies. The pound and the dollar were both simply different weights of gold.
So under the classical gold standard, was there a constant price increase as there has been during the 20th century?
No. In fact, if you go back to maybe 1800 or so, and you compare what the price level was then to what it was in 1913, let's say, right before the Federal Reserve System came into existence, you find that there was actual a gentle price deflation. Basically, people could buy probably about 20 to 25% more with their dollar in 1913 than they could in the 1800s, which meant that prices fell.
Well, with falling prices are definitely a great thing, but we're coming close to a break here on Radio Free Market. But after the break, we're going to talk more about this, but I just kind of want to lead into the break with what exactly the central event was that caused this massive change from being, deflationary currency money to inflationary fiat currency?
Well, the central event was obviously the in the United States, the formation of the Federal Reserve by law.
Okay. Well, like I said, we're coming up on break here on Radio Free Market. I'm Drew Yelm, and I'm sitting in studio with Zach Halstead, and we are talking with Dr. Joseph Salerno about the history of money, sound and unsound. Please stand by.
Welcome back to Radio Free Market. I'm Zach Halstead, sitting in studio with Drew Yelm. We are talking with Dr. Joseph Salerno today. We're going over his book, Money, Sound, and Unsound, From Gold to Paper in the 20th Century. Before the break, we were discussing what exactly is a classical gold standard. And this really changed going from the 19th century to the 20th century as countries decoupled from gold, especially during World War I. What was the effect of this decoupling, Dr. Salerno?
What occurred was that the national banks gained more power during World War I. Every single belligerent country had its central bank go off the gold standard within 2 weeks of the beginning of World War I. And the reason why governments always move away from the gold standard during war is because wars are so expensive that to increase taxes to pay for the war would make the war extremely unpopular and would cause social unrest. So in order to finance wars, and this is true even before World War I, obviously the Civil War and so on, governments wanted to be able to print paper money to pay for the enormous expenditures on the military and weapons and so on. So when war was over, many countries had inflated tremendously. Great Britain, France, Italy, we had huge inflations. So they wanted to go back to the gold standard after World War I. And so there was a lot of talk about how to go back. And what they wanted the advantages of a gold standard, fixed exchange rates, and so on, but they didn't want to have to deflate their money supplies. And so what basically came about was something called the gold exchange standard, which was more or less a phony gold standard. It was really only the U.S. and Great Britain after 1925 that were, their currencies were convertible into gold, and then other currencies held the dollar or the pound sterling as the reserves for their own currencies. So, which meant that the U.S. could then increase the money supply, and foreign countries would not demand gold from the U.S. They would be willing to hold these extra dollars that went abroad as U.S. citizens who got this new money bought more imports and sold fewer exports.
So you mentioned that this gold exchange standard allowed central banks and governments to expand the gold supply. And
right.
many contemporary commentators state that the problems of the Great Depression were due to tight money. But didn't the United States aggressively expand the money supply during the 1920s before the Great Depression?
You're absolutely right. It did. Depending on how you measure the money supply, it increased the money supply at a rate of probably between 1921 and 1928, let's say, at a rate of about 7% per year, 6 or 7% per year. Now, that did not show in price increases. The reason why is because capitalist economies are extremely productive. The U.S. was extremely productive, and as a result of the new technology that was coming in and new products and more saving and investment, you had a tremendous increase in the supply of goods. You had refrigerators coming in. You had radios, electricity. So goods expanded tremendously, and as a result, their prices would have fallen were it not for the fact that the Fed increased the money supply so greatly. So it prevented the natural tendency of a capitalist market economy to bring about a fall in prices, which had occurred in the 19th century. Now, what fooled economists was American and British economists thought that this was great because prices were about the same in 1929 as they were in 1921. But Austrian economists, Ludwig von Mises, Friedrich Hayek, and others, pointed out that, in fact, this hid a great inflation because that increase in the money supply prevented the prices from falling and at the same time caused a huge real estate boom in the U.S. as well as, of course, the stock market boom.
And ultimately, what was the point of the 1920s gold exchange standard?
Well, again, it was to save on gold. It was to prevent countries from having to deflate their money supplies or to devalue their currencies. So they didn't want to reduce the value of their currencies in terms of gold. I mean, they had to some extent, but it allowed them to back their currencies up with what ultimately was gold, but it was really gold held by the U.S. rather than actually have gold itself. So they were using U.S. dollars and British pounds, for example, to back their currencies. That is, the other countries in Europe.
And also, many Keynesian and monetarists will point to the fact that during the Great Depression, other countries abandoned the gold standard, and that, you know, apparently led to a greater increase in GDP. But if they're going off the gold standard, isn't that just a really clever way to fudge the numbers?
Well, going off the gold standard, I mean, if you increase the money supply, you can get a short run increase in output. Okay, and you do that by increasing the money supply, which then depresses interest rates below the market level, and that misleads entrepreneurs and businessmen into borrowing more and starting projects and creating jobs that, in the long run, can't be sustained. Okay, they're just bad investments, and they're putting people in the wrong jobs, jobs that are low-value jobs. So when you stop increasing the money supply, you're going to get a collapse. That's a depression. So we did have some temporary, in those countries that went off the gold standard, like Great Britain and so on, you had some temporary relief from the depression. At least it caused an upward movement in the economy. Okay.
So Dr. Salerno, you mentioned that all these countries have been off the gold standard, and the United States especially, How did this system actually go off the gold standard? How did the United States finally abandon the gold exchange standard?
Well, in 1933, there was a bank holiday in which the banks were closed for a while, and two thirds of them were when they were allowed to open again about 5 or 6 days later. One third, I think, never reopened because they were just bankrupt, and then the other two thirds did reopen. But at that point, President Roosevelt took us off the gold standard, which meant that it became illegal for American citizens to own gold. Not only could they not get their gold back from the banks, that is, that the dollar is now inconvertible, but it was also against the law to hold and own gold. So people had to come in and turn in their gold coins, which had been the amount of gold coins in circulation had been decreasing after World War One because there was a campaign waged against people using gold coins. They were called old-fashioned and so on, and that paper money was much more convenient and safe to carry around. But in any case, to get back to the 1930s, people had to turn in their gold. The only people who could own gold were people who were licensed as jewelers or dentists who were then permitted to own gold. That law was not repealed until 1976. Americans were not allowed to own gold, even in foreign countries. You couldn't have gold held for you in Canada. That was against the law until 1976.
So moving forward about 10 years after the destruction of World War II, the world tried again to implement an international gold exchange standard called the Bretton Woods Treaty. How did this system work?
This is a terrible system. This was really a totally phony gold standard or a pseudo gold standard. The U.S. government and central bank agreed to convert the dollar into gold, but only for foreign central banks and foreign governments, not for American citizens. And they agreed to convert at the rate of $35 per ounce. So if you had 35 U.S. dollars, you could come in and get 1 ounce of gold, if you were a foreign official institution. American citizens were using paper. Now, all the other countries, Great Britain, France, and so on, Germany, they then had fixed exchange rates with the dollar, and they backed their currency with dollars. So what grew up was this sort of gold exchange standard using dollars as the world reserve currency. Now, this set up very bad, perverse incentives, it's called in economics, very bad incentives for the U.S. government, because the U.S. government could create money, and yet there would be no demand for gold. See, as they created money, what would happen, or the Federal Reserve created money in the U.S. economy, that would cause prices to rise in the U.S. economy. American citizens would buy fewer goods in the U.S., and they'd import more goods from abroad. At the same time, foreigners, at fixed exchange rates, would find that American prices were rising, so they would stop buying U.S. exports. So to make a long story short, we had huge balance of payments deficits beginning after 1958, and so dollars were flowing into the hands of these foreign countries. And eventually the dollars built up to the point where they were very suspicious that they would not get their gold back. Initially, we had something like $25 billion in gold in the U.S., let's say in 1950, and there were $12 billion held abroad. that could be converted into gold. So there was much more gold than there was dollars, so foreign countries weren't worried. But by the mid to late 1960s, after all of the inflation to pay for the Vietnam War and for the war on poverty that President Lyndon Johnson instituted, by that time, inflation had been so great that the number of foreign dollar liabilities that these foreign countries held were something like $80 billion. And in the meantime, we had lost some gold, so our gold stock had been down to $12 billion. So at that point, France began to demand to convert their dollars into gold, and Germany made similar demands. But the U.S. basically blackmailed these European countries by saying, well, if you demand your gold, we're going to have to remove our nuclear umbrella, so we're not going to protect you against the Russians anymore. So the Germans knuckled under, but the French actually dropped out of NATO at that point and started their own nuclear force. So by 1971, there was a continuing run on the U.S. gold stock, and there were estimates that the U.S. gold would have run out in 2 weeks. At that point, in August of 71, President Nixon closed the gold standard, repudiated the solemn pledge to convert dollars into gold, and at that point, we were completely off the gold standard. And that's when you see, by the way, that a tremendous inflation beginning here in the U.S. and in the world economy.
President Nixon also implemented price and wage controls. What were their effects on the economy?
Yeah, what he did was he wanted to increase his chances of getting reelected in 1972. So he and his administration leaned on the chairman of the Federal Reserve System, who was Arthur Burns, who was a Republican who served in the Eisenhower administration and was a friend of Nixon's. And so Burns basically said, look, if you want me to inflate the money supply and avoid inflation,
you're going to have to impose wage
and price control.
We're coming up on a break here on Radio Free Market. Please stay tuned for more with Dr. Joseph Salerno. Welcome back to Radio Free Market. I'm Drew Yelm, sitting in the studio with Zach Halstead, and we are talking with Dr. Joseph Salerno about money, sound and unsound, from gold to paper in the 20th century. And before the break, we were talking about Richard Nixon and the Arthur Burns Fed, and if you could just continue on that point you were talking about, the Nixon administration leaning on the Federal Reserve for their politics.
Yeah, so the Nixon administration did lean on Arthur Burns, did put pressure on him to increase the money supply, and Burns made a deal basically with Nixon to the effect that if he did that, then to avoid price increases, the Nixon administration would have to impose wage and price controls. So I think we had something like four different phases of wage and price controls between 1971 and 1974 or so, when they were finally removed. It was during that period that we had huge gas lines and so on. We had the first oil crisis because prices weren't allowed to rise to balance supply and demand. And the economy was really in disarray. And when they finally allowed the price controls and wage controls to lapse, it was actually called the wage and price freeze. When that freeze was lifted, price, of course, shot up, and that's when we got stagflation. Okay, because the money supply was being increased, and because interest rates were being falsified and financial assets were being bid up in price, we had this false inflationary boom, which then collapsed into a depression, recession, a very bad recession between 1973 and 1975. And so that was the first big instance of what was called stagflation, which really means inflationary recession, having the worst of both possible worlds, high unemployment and rapidly rising prices. And that's what killed Keynesian economics at that point.
Well, I guess as a side point here, after the Bretton Woods system failed and the United States dollar was no longer tied to gold, and the United States had proven itself to be untrustworthy as a reserve currency, how did the United States dollar still remain the world's reserve currency after 1971?
For a while, I mean, most of the world trade was priced in dollars. The dollar was inflationary, but so were many of the other European countries, very inflationary. So there was not a good replacement, let's say, for the dollar as reserve currency. As we got into towards the 1980s, inflation again spiked up tremendously in the late 70s, and even reached something like 16% per year, sort of at the end of 1979, early 1980. At that point, they got rid of a very short-time Fed chairman, I think his name was William Miller, and replaced him with Paul Volcker. So and by that time, the monetarists were beginning to have influence, and the monetarists, the one virtue is that they do emphasize the connection between the money supply and inflation, rather than inflation being caused by oil shocks or bad weather and high food prices and all that nonsense that the Keynesians were spouting. So Volcker did restrain the growth of the money supply. He didn't stop it. He restrained it. And so we had two recessions within a very short period from 1980 to 1982. But during that period, inflation was brought down, okay? And it was also a very deep recession.
So
go ahead.
Well, I was just going to point out that I had read in a book by Robert Auerbach that basically Volcker was not even that popular with Ronald Reagan President Reagan during the 80s, because his more or less deflationist policies were kind of ruining his great expansion of the government at that particular point in time.
Well, I mean, there was a crisis, in, I believe it was the Mexican crisis in 1982 or 1983 or so, and that was and I believe that the U.S. Inflated the money supply to bail out Mexico, but also to get us out of the recession. So actually, there was the inflation again started in 1983, and it was during that period that we didn't see a lot of that showing up in prices. Okay, though we did see a big bubble created in the stock market, and we had the stock market crash of 1987. Okay, and that economists expected a recession after that, but there was no recession for a while until 1989. But it was in 1989 that because of this inflation in the 80s, let me just step back for a moment, there were a lot of bad loans made. There was deregulation of savings and loan associations, which usually were restricted, which had been restricted to simply loaning money on mortgages for people borrowing for houses. And when the restrictions were removed, they made many more speculative-type loans. So the savings and loan associations, that whole industry, basically collapsed in 1989, 1990. Okay, as one of the effects of this sort of hidden inflationary boom we had from 83 onward.
So, Dr. Salerno, going back to the Nixon administration, another change that he made was to change inflation calculations from regular inflation to core inflation, and the Federal Reserve makes monetary policy decisions based on this measure. Could you kind of explain the difference between core and regular inflation and why this is destructive to the dollar?
Yeah, core inflation removes certain so-called volatile commodities from the index, which means commodities whose prices rise a lot, right? And mainly in an age of inflation, it's just rising. It's not they don't usually fall very much. But so it was gasoline was removed, oil was removed, and housing was removed. So, basically energy prices and food prices, food prices. Only later on that housing prices were removed in the 1990s. So, basically, it took out a large part of what people buy. And so that now with core inflation, which is really...
Dr. Salerno, I have to interrupt you real quick. We're coming up another break here on Radio Free Market. We're talking with Dr. Joseph Salerno on Money Sound and Unsound. Please join us after the break. Thank you. Welcome back to Radio Free Market. I'm your guest host, Drew Yelm. In studio with me is Zach Halstead, and we are talking with Dr. Joseph Salerno about money, sound and unsound, from gold to paper in the 20th century. Before the break, we were talking about the changes to the inflation calculation real quick. I think you said you had something you wanted to finish up there real quick, Dr. Salerno?
Yes. So core inflation basically removes energy prices and food prices. And then in the 1990s, the index, the CPI, was revised even further by removing housing prices and putting in a rental equivalent of owner-occupied houses, which, again, understated increases in housing prices. And then you had some other adjustments, hedonic adjustments, which means that, for example, if a car now has four airbags instead of just two airbags, well, then... Since the car is a higher quality product, Well, then, if the price goes up by 10%, it has to be adjusted downward because part of the increase in price comes from the cost of the higher quality. So, in other words, it's reducing the inflation rate in that respect, below the actual rise in prices.
Yeah, some of those things just sound so ridiculous. Like you mentioned the rental adjustment rate, and I'd read about that where they basically say that if you own your home, they add into the GDP the amount of money that you would pay to rent your own home. Is that correct?
Right. There's what's called an imputed rent in economics. It's a rent that you would pay if you were renting the home. Okay. So those prices tend to rise more slowly. The rents more slowly than the housing prices. And the other thing they do, by the way, just very quickly, is something called the substitute. They account for substitution bias. So if the price of beef is going up by a certain percentage, they reduce that percentage because they say, well, you know what? People shift to lower priced chicken and hot dogs and so on, so that they reduce the price. They're not paying as much as they would have if they continued to buy the same amount of steak. So in other words, you're not giving the same weight to that increase in the price of steak, for example.
And I'd even read somewhere that some of these hedonic adjustments and other imputations that they make to the GDP, they basically add something like one-third to the nominal value of GDP. Is that anywhere near accurate?
No, I haven't seen that statistic.
Okay.
So I'm not sure about that.
Okay. Well, anyway, getting back to, after Paul Volcker was the chairman, after that we had Alan Greenspan. And how did, after the savings and loan bust, how did Greenspan manage to create two back-to-back bubbles, first the dot-com bubble, then the housing bubble?
Well, Greenspan wanted to inflate the economy out of the recession of 1989-1990. Money was tight there for a little while, and in fact, President George Bush, the first President Bush, and his administration put enormous pressure leading up to the 1992 elections on Greenspan to increase the money supply. And to this day, the first George Bush blames Greenspan for causing him to lose the election, which is an interesting point. But he's actually correct in some sense because citizen voters will look back about 1 year on the economy leading up to the election, and if it's doing well, the incumbent party will not lose votes for that reason. Okay, but if it's been in a recession within the past year, then you lose votes as a result of that if you're the incumbent. So to make a long story short, it was after that when Clinton came in, and that Greenspan again began to increase the money supply, and eventually by 1995 he made a statement that there was irrational exuberance in the economy, meaning that stock prices were rising too quickly to be justified by the fundamentals of, underlying supply and demand forces. But then, sometime in 1996, I believe, he changed his tune, and he began to say, you know what, our economy is much more productive because of the high-tech industries and so on, so that these high stock prices are simply reflecting this greater productivity, and therefore we have a, quote, new economy, unquote, which justified, the huge bubble that eventually burst in the high tech stocks, in NASDAQ in particular, that collapsed in 1999, 2000, and we went to another recession. And then to get out of that recession, by the way, the second blow to the economy was 9/11, which occurred in 2001. And so Greenspan felt justified at that point in, again, really gunning the money supply in 2001. And what he began to do to justify this, and I think this is a very important way of explaining what occurred in the last decade, was to begin to blame deflation, okay? Bernanke, who was on the Board of Governors at the time, gave a speech in November of 2002 in which he said that, we're close to deflation. Inflation is much lower than it really should be. It's so low that, we're risking deflation. And not many people paid attention to that speech, but then later, a few months later in April, Greenspan began to talk about this risk of too low inflation causing deflation. And so that was a justification for increasing the money supply. or beginning to increase it in 2002.
So, and then they just continued to create more money throughout the 2000s to fuel the housing boom. Is that what?
Yes, exactly. They pushed the interest rate down to 1% for a full year. The federal funds rate, which is what the Fed targets, went from something like over 6% all the way down to 1%. And they held it at 1% for that period of time. And now people focus on the interest rate, but what's important also is the money supply. And between 2001 and 2005, depending on how you measure the money supply, there were $2 trillion new dollars of money injected into the economy in those 5 years, which is about a 50% increase. And that, just doing a back of the envelope calculation, the Fed was increasing the money supply, if you look at M2 or MZM, at about $1 billion per day. So people ignore this when they claim that, you know, it's problems, inherent problems with the financial markets that caused the bubble and then later the bust.
And then, you know, just since then, since we've had this continued housing bubble and the subsequent collapse in 2008, there's been an even more massive amount of monetary creation in that particular point in time. How does that compare to what was done previously? I mean, could you talk about, you know, inflation expectations during the first 5 years of the decade versus these last 2 years?
What's happened in the last few years is that the Fed has, you know, more than doubled its balance sheet, which means that it's created a lot of bank reserves by buying up not only what it traditionally bought, which was government bonds, treasury securities, but also by buying up mortgages and commercial paper and so on. And as a result of that, banks have a lot of reserves. Their reserves, you know, increased tremendously. But the banks, because of the bad economy, the banks have not been very eager to loan those reserves out. So there has been increases in the money supply, but not of the same magnitude that you had between 2001 and 2005. That's starting to change now. We're starting to see an uptick in the inflation as banks do begin to loan more, and rather an uptick in the rate of increase in the money supply as banks begin to loan more out as confidence is returning to the economy. And I would argue it's a false confidence, by the way. A lot of these rises in prices, in commodities prices, in land prices in the Midwest, we have junk bond prices rising and so on, are the result of the Fed's quantitative easing policy. Okay, quantitative easing 1, quantitative easing 2. And that simply means printing money.
So we've printed all this money in the last couple of years, coming out of the 2008 crisis, but we haven't really seen 1970s style inflation in the United States. Can you kind of talk about the reasons behind this? And I know it's hard to predict the future, but when will this inflation start to actually hit the markets and cause a increase in prices?
Okay, as I said, the Fed didn't directly increase the money supply. The Fed directly increases bank reserves. If the banks don't loan these out, you don't get much of an increase in the money supply. So for the first few years after the crisis, you know, 2008, 2009, the new money did not get into circulation. It's beginning to get into circulation now. And so what you're going to see is prices rising more rapidly. But also there's some confidence returning to the economy. So for a while it might look like the economy is recovering. You're going to see unemployment still stuck at a very high level, 8.8%. You're going to start to see that fall. But the problem will become how the Fed's going to react when prices begin to increase at rapid rates. And also, by the way, we sort of have the Fed has restarted a stock market boom. Okay, there's been a tremendous increase in stock prices from the bottom of the bust to today. Okay, so when all that happens, the Fed's going to have a tough decision to make. What should we do? Should we slow down the rate of increase in the money supply? If they do that, then you're going to get basically stagflation. Then you're going to get them fooling around with trying to adjust the money supply but still increasing it, and prices are going to be increasing, and at the same time you're not going to get unemployment coming down. You're not going to get factories putting more people to work and producing more and more. You're going to get a very slow sort of stagnant economy. You could get sort of a Japanese lost decade of the 1990s, where you're inflating and you're running deficits, and that's something else that's scaring the American people. But it's not curing your unemployment. It's not putting the real economy back to work.
Speaking of Japan, the yen recently strengthened considerably against other currencies in the wake of their earthquake there, so much so even that the G7 nations underwent coordinated intervention to weaken the yen. What was the rationale behind this? I mean, why did the yen get so big so fast, and then was this a good policy?
The yen got very strong because when the disaster hit in Japan, or the series of disasters hit in Japan, the assets that they owned in foreign countries, they began to sell off. And so they sold them for foreign currencies. Let's say they held, you know, stocks or bonds in the U.S. and, you know, other countries. They sold them for dollars, and they used those dollars to buy yen. So that movement back of capital, that capital moving back to Japan, okay, to help alleviate and respond to the problems that they were having, was what drove the yen up. Okay, so capital was moving into Japan rather than out of Japan. So that was why it drove the yen up. But at the same time, when the yen becomes more expensive, their exports begin to shrink, and their imports increase. So the coordinated effort to drive down the yen may have been to help their export industries, okay, to prevent them from shrinking too much. But that defeats the purpose of moving the capital back to Japan, because what you want to do is you want to basically cash out these assets and buy real goods and services, because your economy has suffered a big blow from the natural disaster.
I kind of want to shift the debate towards China now. So they're one of the largest foreign holders of U.S. treasuries, and these are, of course, denominated in U.S. dollar, which has dramatically decreased in value this year. And I'm kind of wanting to get your take on how you see this relationship progressing between Beijing and Washington, given the fact that China has repeatedly warned that loose U.S. monetary policy threatens the future of the dollar.
Yeah, China is sort of on the horns of a dilemma, because China, as you said, holds a lot of dollar-denominated assets. So when the dollar depreciates, and is expected to depreciate, the value of those assets go down. So what China could do, and this is sort of the other horn of the dilemma, is to begin to sell off the U.S. assets. But if they sell them off too fast, that's going to cause them to decrease in value, so that the U.S. dollar is going to be driven down even more, and whatever U.S. assets that China still holds will lose value in that respect. So if China were to sell off its U.S. assets, it could really drive the dollar down, and that would cause interest rates in the U.S. to rise, as other foreign investors in the U.S. begin to pull their capital out. So at that point, the burden of financing this huge government, these deficits, these $1.5 trillion deficits that we've had now 3 years in a row, is going to fall on the shoulders of the American taxpayer. So, you know, people, American citizens, bash China, the U.S. government bashes China. But the fact that China is willing to buy all of this debt from the U.S. prevents us as citizens of the U.S. from having to bear the burden of the high interest rates that would occur if the U.S. couldn't borrow from the rest of the world, so that we'd have less money to purchase houses with, cars with. I mean, the ramifications would go throughout the economy.
And with the dollar, the Chinese acting as a reserve holder of dollars, hasn't the United States really exported a lot of inflation to China, and they're coming to see that nowadays as well?
Yeah, that's a very good point. Because China wants to keep its currency undervalued, it wants to keep a fixed exchange rate between its currency and the dollar. And because we're relatively to China, you know, we have this inflation that's going on, and also the deficit causing dollars to be purchased by the Chinese. In order to purchase those dollars, they have to create their own yuan, additional yuan. So they increase their own money supply. So now you see a housing boom in China. You see, you know, prices going up elsewhere in China. You see a lot of investment activity in China that's resulting in, for example, cities with no one living in them as you have more and more construction. So China is suffering an inflationary boom as a result of importing our inflation by purchasing the unwanted dollars that are flowing in from their citizens, from the investments in U.S. assets.
And going forward, what else do you see happening, I guess, to completely go to the other side of the Eastern Hemisphere? Within Europe, they're also having a lot of trouble over there as well with debt. The Greeks are starting to default in their debts. The Irish, the Icelandic country, I mean, all these different countries in Europe as well are starting to go down as well with the euro.
Yeah, those are the PIIGS countries, the pig countries, Portugal, Italy, Greece, Ireland, and Spain. They're having problems. Greece has been bailed out. Ireland has been offered a bailout. In any case, what happens is that these countries with the historically more inflationary currencies in Europe. And once they became, so they had to pay very high interest rates to borrow from abroad because of the feared depreciation of their currency. So if you're going to loan to a currency to a country that had a very inflationary currency, you would charge them high interest rates. But once they adopted the euro, once they were allowed into the European Union or the European Monetary Union, at that point, they were using a currency that was fairly strong, which was controlled by German Bundesbank, which is historically sort of a very strong currency, the mark had been. And to make a long story short, they then sort of free rode on the backs of the good reputation of
Dr.
the euro.
Cerno, we're coming up on a break here on Radio Free Market. And after the break, we're going to continue talking with Dr. Salerno. Please stand by.
Welcome back to Radio Free Market. This is Zach Halstead. I'm sitting in studio with Drew Yelm. Today we are talking with Dr. Joseph Salerno about money, sound and unsound, from gold to paper in the 20th century. Before the break, Dr. Salerno was giving us his view on Europe and the reasons for their continuing troubles with their euro-denominated currency and how this affects their member countries.
Yeah. So the weaker countries like Greece, and the countries with the weaker currencies that now had the strong euro could now borrow at lower interest rates. So basically they ran huge fiscal deficits because they could borrow from abroad to finance these deficits. And that resulted in inflation. That resulted in out-of-control government spending. And so now they can't pay their debts. So they're seeking bailouts from the rest of the European Union.
So, Dr. Salerno, throughout this discussion we've had today, we've kind of been talking about how the world has shifted from free market principles to more interventionist principles, and it seems the world has grown more accustomed and reliant on this government intervention in recent years. How do you think this attitude shift will affect the structure of the world's currency system in the future?
Well, reality is intruding here. I mean, there is the shift in ideology. There has been a shift in ideology, as you said, towards more interventionism. But I think there are signs that might be tempered by what's going on, and that is that the euro is collapsing, the dollar is depreciating, it's not fulfilling its role as reserve currency safe or a safe haven where people during times of stress in the world economy would invest in dollars. So that now you've heard in the last year talk, by the World Bank, by China, Brazil, include getting rid of the U.S. Dollar as the sole reserve currency and maybe substituting a basket of currencies, which would include gold. And we've had talk of some sort of a gold standard or targeting the price of gold on the world level, not a true gold standard, of course. So I think the economic problems that we're having are causing people to reassess this interventionist philosophy.
Well, and what do you see the solution is to this mess? I mean, how can we transition back to a real gold standard or a system of competing currencies taking the power to inflate away from the state?
Yeah, I think that has to be done, for example, in the U.S. I mean, we can do that alone, and I think the first step is what you sort of mentioned, competing currencies. I think legal tender laws should be abolished. And all taxes, excise taxes, sales taxes, capital gains taxes on gold and silver should be removed. And also any regulations that prevent U.S. banks from offering American citizens accounts in denominated foreign currencies or even accounts in gold and silver. And because the people who have done that have been prosecuted under the counterfeiting laws. So once you remove all these legal barriers, I think then people can pick and choose what sorts of things they want to use for their medium of exchange, and that will put a lot of pressure on the Fed. Even if you don't go back to the gold standard right away, they'll put pressure on the Fed to stop the inflation. So I think that's the first step back.
All right. Well, we are coming up on the end of the show here at Radio Free Market. I'd really like to thank Dr. Joseph Salerno for being with us today. And if you have any last words.
Parting words would be that the ultimate solution to the currency problem is to go back to the gold standard. I think the U.S. can do that alone over time, and that other countries will naturally want a stable currency to tie onto. So I think that is what we should be looking forward to, and that's what we should be trying to educate people about.
Again, thank you so much, Dr. Salerno, for being with us here today on Radio Free Market. This is Drew Yelm and Zach Halstead and Radio Free Market. Please visit us on the web at radiofreemarket.com, where you can subscribe for free to all of our shows on iTunes or visit our Radio Free Market archives for easy downloads. Also, check out Mises.org, where you can find more work by Dr. Joseph Salerno and also, too, to check out his book, Money, Sound, and Unsound. Until next week, wherever you are, please stand up for freedom. Thank you for listening.